Welcome to the Security Perimeter Podcast, an island of insanity, starring my dad, Athanasios Christoulos. This is an amazing podcast, really, the best. You're gonna love this, guaranteed, 100%. We are gonna make podcasting great again, promise. And now, my dad, Athanasios, aka Saki Christoulos.
This week's episode features Craig Deere. You'll hear a little bit more about his biography in a moment. It's a pretty long interview, so I think we're just going to get right into it without too much detail on other things. But I would like to say that it would be nice if the listeners, especially the regular listeners, send some comments on what they think about the podcast. And send me an email at perimeterpodcast@gmail.com, or you can make a comment on the Facebook webpage, which is The Security Perimeter. It really would be helpful for me if I could get some feedback from the listeners. Other than that, in terms of housekeeping, the podcast is growing. There are more and more people listening to it every week, and that's making me happy. I guess that suggests that I, at least a certain number of people, find it interesting. Because this is a particularly long interview with Dr. Craig Deere, I'm just going to leave my opening remarks to what I've said. So please enjoy the podcast and email me at perimeterpodcast@gmail.com for comments, either positive ones or negative ones or neutral ones. Enjoy the podcast. Okay, so in today's episode of the Security Perimeter Podcast, I'd like to welcome Dr. Craig Deere, who is an old friend of mine. We go back, about 10 or so years. Yeah. Craig and I have met in different contexts, mostly here in Mexico, but also we've done some presentations together in the International Studies Association, and hopefully this year we'll be doing the same thing. Craig is one of those extra special guests. Craig has a very, very long history of service, both academically and United States, as an Army officer, as a colonel, right? You're a colonel right now? You're still a colonel, aren't you?
No. Well, retired.
You're a retired colonel. Okay. So let me tell you what Craig has... what Craig's doing now, and Craig now serves on the faculty of the National Defense University. I'm sorry, no, he doesn't serve on the... Does he still serve on the... Okay, he does... Okay, he does still serve. There you go. He's been there since 2001. He joined Center for Hemispheric Defense Studies. No, but you... It says here that you... Since March of 2010, you've
right,
been
so
at
from
CISA.
From 2001 to 2010, Center for Hemispheric Defense Studies, 2010 to present,
yeah.
CISA, College of International Security Affairs.
There you go. Okay, College of International Security Affairs. And he's been Dean of Academic Affairs there from 2004 to 2007. Since he went to CISA, his duties have included Associate Dean of Academic Affairs, Interim Dean of Academic Affairs, and is currently Dean of Administration. Prior to joining the National Defense University, Dr. Deere served in the U.S. Army for 20 years with a variety of assignments specializing in military intelligence and Latin American foreign affairs officer duties. His principal assignments included troop time with the 82nd Airborne, one of my favorite, where he served for 5 years as battalion intelligence officer, ground surveillance radar, platoon leader, Assistant G3. What's a G3?
G3 is operations.
Okay, G3 operations officer. And participated in Operation Urgent Fury in Grenada. You know they made a movie about that, right?
They did, yeah. I was so depressed that they didn't call me as a technical advisor.
And company commander of an intelligence company team. He was deputy commander for Joint Counterintelligence Operations Element in Honduras, following which he served as assistant professor in the Department of Social Sciences at the at West Point, and he subsequently served as assistant defense attaché in Mexico City in the early 1990s. As troop commander of a special operations unit, and spent 2 years as country director, the Office of Inter-American Affairs, in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, where he was responsible for crafting defense policy matters for Mexico. He entered the Army in 1980, has received a Bachelor's of Arts in Political Science from Arizona, I think. Is that right? And then a master's in international relations and PhD from the Paul Nitzsche School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins. And he graduated from the U.S. Marine Corps University's Command and General Staff College. But you really have a soft spot for Mexico, from what I understand. And he's completely fluent in Spanish. Craig also served as senior advisor on the National Security Council as the point man for hemispheric security for a little while. The reason I actually invited him was because he just recently put out a book called The Tale of Two Eagles, U.S.-Mexico Bilateral Defense Relationship in the Post-Cold War Period. It's an awesome book. Craig, thank you very much for sending me a copy via Capitan Calles.
My pleasure.
And it's a long book. It's a pretty big book. I like some of your chapter titles. they're interesting. But you know, he tries to go through some of the ups and downs of the Mexico U.S. defense cooperation relationship. And in the end, he's optimistic, especially when you talk about in the epilogue with Peña Nieto that. Things could move forward. I don't know. I'm not so optimistic, but
we'll get into that.
And we're not going to go back to the Spanish conquista, which you do have a chapter on that.
I do. Well, I have to paint the context for the reader. So the primary reader is a U.S. audience. I started writing just without that, but it soon dawned on me that if I didn't provide the basics. They wouldn't have the context to understand what was going on.
Where I wanted to maybe begin the discussion is, it seems to me as though you identify, I guess, the Zedillo administration from 1994 to 2000 as the big turning point. Is that right?
Let me just thank you for the opportunity and make one minor correction. Since my return from the NSC in the White House, I am no longer the dean of administration. I've gone back to the faculty. I'm looking forward to teaching again, so that's all good. You're right. I do tend to put sort of the watershed, if you will, of the break in sort of the classic U.S.-Mexico defense relationship of being, formal, distant, and somewhat cool during the Cedillo sexenio, although a preview of that was seen during the Salinas sexenio when General Sullivan, the former U.S. Army Chief of Staff, was the first U.S. Army Chief of Staff to ever visit Mexico. And he and his counterpart, General Antonio Rivello Bazán, mm-hmm. Visited each other three times over a two-year period. So three times each, so six times in a two-year period. Hadn't happened before, hasn't happened since. So that was a very unique case of leadership by Sullivan. And it sort of, I think, maybe started to set the stage, but the big change, obviously within the context of NAFTA, mm-hmm. was when Secretary of Defense William J. Perry visited his counterpart in Mexico City in October of 95, and it was the first time a sitting U.S. Secretary of Defense had ever visited our neighbor to the south. And you think we've been neighbors forever, right? And even though we hadn't had our defense institution or defense department was built in 47, mm-hmm. prior to that, even during the sort of the afterglow of World War II, no U.S. Secretary had ever visited. So that was the beginning, and his efforts along with General Enrique Cervantes Aguirre, who was the Secretary of Defense, supported, I think, at least tacitly, by President Zedillo, really started to change that distant relationship. And it hasn't been a straight linear curve up. There have been ups and downs, but yeah, since 95, so now 20 years, it's been the trend has been improvement.
Okay, so in a nuts and bolts kind of way, what did cooperation look like in the late 1990s after the signing of NAFTA?
Right. So prior to that, it's not to say that there was no relationship. There were, you know, U.S. officers went to school in Mexico. Mexican officers went to school in the U.S., But the numbers were very limited, mm-hmm. And beginning with the Perry tenure, we see a dramatic increase in IMET, International Military Education and Training funds. Went from, you know, in the tens of thousands of dollars range up to actually $1 million. So it was a dramatic increase. That's when another great increase in counter-narcotics funding on the defense side of the house, not to talk about Justice Department and the PGR and the old PJF, but with the Mexican Army and Air Force, we see a dramatic increase there as well. Training opportunities. There was one initiative where the U.S. provided 73 Vietnam-era UH-1 helicopters to the Mexican Air Force to provide mobility for newly created GAFE units, mm-hmm. That were doing counter-narcotics work. We brought a lot of those GAFE soldiers up to Fort Bragg to train. So we really start to see a what I would call a dramatic increase in efforts to try to work more closely together. Mm-hmm. Now, this is within a context where the Mexican military in general, the army in particular, for historical reasons that our Mexican listeners will understand very well, the Mexican army was reluctant to do this. They didn't trust the U.S. for understandable reasons, and so it was a long, slow slog. But that's when it began.
Who does the pushing on the Mexican side to get the Mexican army to start shifting?
To cooperate, if you will?
Yeah, in spite of historical problems.
Right. So even though NAFTA was negotiated primarily between Salinas and Bush 41, Zedillo comes into power. Don't forget the peso crisis, and President Clinton found, you know, that enough money to stabilize the peso, mm-hmm. And so that the Zedillo Clinton relationship, I think was very important, and because Clinton and Perry were looking at sort of a rebirth of democracy throughout the region, Mexico of course is a separate case, and so because there was an interest on the U.S. side to improve security and defense issues. Zedillo, I suspect, I wasn't able to interview President Zedillo despite my requests. I think he basically told Cervantes, you will cooperate with these guys. And so, you know, the president's the commander in chief. And so they started to do this. And I was privileged to be a part of that. At the time, I was serving on Secretary Perry's staff within the Office of the Secretary of Defense, and accompanied him on that first visit when Perry met with Cervantes. And I just got to tell you that there was a genuine personal rapport that developed between those two senior leaders, despite the fact that you know, obviously Cervantes spoke some English, Perry spoke none, no Spanish, I should say. And all of their communication was done through interpreters, and yet it was just very. I mean, Perry was still is obviously a a very kind gentleman. Cervantes was clearly impressed by that, by his sincerity, his genuineness. And that personal relationship assisted with everything else. And as you know, the nature of centralization of authority in Mexico, in particular in the army, and when the boss says something, you just say, mi general, and you move forward. So that's what started it. One of the bumps in the road came when Perry retired. And I mentioned these helicopters that had been sent down. It's a whole big part in Chapter 5, as you may recall, so I won't get into that now. But without someone to talk to, Perry didn't know, Cervantes didn't know Perry's successor, Secretary of Defense Cohen, former Senator Cohen. And so he didn't have anybody to talk to and was frustrated. And finally, they sent the helicopters back, and the front page newspaper article in Mexico was, nos mandaron chatarra. They sent us junk, and we're going to send it back. And so it was solid for about 2 years until Perry retired. Then it cooled off again. And then we, of course, have the election, the historic election of Vicente Fox in 2000. And there we have another great, very strong relationship between Bush 43 and Fox, at least until 9/11.
Yeah.
And then
it all changes after 9/11.
Right.
So what about the Navy in the 90s? What was going on with them? The Mexican Navy, I mean.
Right, sure. So if a lot of people don't know about the broader defense relationship or the Army to Army relationship, they knew even less about the Navy relationship. And what I understood, but the research for the book just brought out much more clearly to me, the Mexican Navy has always had a strong relationship with primarily the U.S. Coast Guard, but also the U.S. Navy. And I say primarily the U.S. Coast Guard because when you talk to many Mexican naval officers, not all, but many, they will say, in essence, the Mexican Navy is much more akin to the U.S. Coast Guard than the U.S. Navy, because the U.S. Navy is a blue water Navy responsible for going all over the world. The Mexican Navy historically hasn't had those responsibilities. It's been much more homeland defense, if you will, and also has similar missions. It's got environmental missions, search and rescue missions that are those that the U.S. Coast Guard does. And so the Mexican Navy has always been quite close with their U.S. counterparts. You just didn't read about it in the press.
Yeah.
The Mexican Navy is the much smaller cousin to the Mexican Army. They receive a fraction of the budget, but they do good work. And so so Perry goes down and he meets with Bo Cervantes on the Army side and Lorenzo Franco, Admiral Lorenzo Franco, who was the Secretary of the Navy. And the relationship was fine. It just wasn't what it was with the Army. And in large part, that's probably because the Mexican Navy was working fine. There was no need to really improve that. And the majority of the U.S. concern was on the Army side.
On the Army side.
With counter-narcotics, with eradication of poppy and marijuana plants, as well as interdicting. You may recall that in the 90s, the Colombians and others were sending aircraft laden with cocaine, crash landing them in the desert or in places throughout Mexico. And they were making so much money on the deal, they just walk away from the crash jet. And that was one of the reasons why the U.S. thought about providing those Hueys so that the Mexican GAFE could respond in time, move quickly to get there before the bad guys got away with all the drugs.
Okay. All right, so Fox comes in and Mexico reorients its foreign policy, and the foreign minister Castaneda says the whole enchilada, which was like, let's remake North America, and 9/11 happens, and how does that affect the defense relationship
right.
between Mexico and the U.S.?
Right, so both, Bush 43 and Fox are brand new. Fox comes in December. Bush comes in the following January. Between December of of 2000 and 9/11, so September 11, 2001, Fox and Bush meet four separate times. You know, Bush comes down, Fox goes up. They're talking about immigration reform. You mentioned, you know, the whole enchilada. In many ways, Castaneda was referring to, you know, strong immigration reform, where we get the whole enchilada in terms of fixing this. And there was great progress. Early on, in terms of the defense change, there wasn't that much. It was sort of business as usual. But then 9/11 happens. And without getting into the minutia, you know, President Fox was not terribly helpful from a U.S. perspective. He said some things that were not appreciated in the North. And so that rather strong relationship, Bush-Fox, went cold. The other thing that happened, of course, is the U.S. starts looking at, is distracted from anything in the region, and it starts paying attention, much more attention to Iraq, and eventually, or of course, first to Afghanistan, then Iraq, et cetera, et cetera. And the big thing that changes and makes things, again, we're talking about this generally upward trend, a definite turn down, was when the U.S., for its own internal purposes, reorganizes itself, obviously creates the Department of Homeland Security, but it also creates this new thing called U.S. Northern Command, which is the U.S. Defense Department has geographic combatant commands, which are responsible for U.S. operations around the world. Southern Command from Guatemala south, Africa Command for Africa, obviously European Command, et cetera, et cetera. The two countries in the world, actually two countries in the world, had never been assigned to a specific geographic combatant command were Mexico and the former Soviet Union or Russia. But with this, when they create Northern Command, the idea is it's a concern about U.S. homeland defense for the first time, and this entity contemplates the inclusion of both Canada and Mexico as part of a command. The U.S. does a rather poor job of socializing this.
Yeah, Mexicans get all nervous about the implications.
Because when it was rolled out, the inartful way that we said it, we said that the commander of U.S. Northern Command will be responsible for operations in Canada, the U.S., and Mexico. And the Mexican Secretary of Defense, you know, General Vega Garcia, said, no, he's not. I'm responsible for operations in Mexico, and as long as I'm the Secretary of Defense, we will have nothing to do with Northern Command. So you have this entity that's responsible for interacting with Mexico, and the Mexican Secretary of Defense says, I'm not talking to you guys.
Okay, and but wait, so, and, Craig, on the political side, this is going on, but these exchanges, these programs, these officer training, the GAFA's going to the U.S., is that still going on while or is there a lull? Because of this?
The lull starts back in 97, 98 when Perry leaves.
Okay.
So Perry's promoting the GAFAs and such. But the other thing, in frankness, is there much of the money that was allocated to do this training, you know, the U.S. Army Special Forces trained virtually all the GAFAs that there were. So that program came to an end.
Okay.
The lull begins in the late 90s. It kind of, again, business as usual in the up until 9/11, and then between 9/11 and this was rolled out, I believe, in October of 2002. That's when you get this sort of political full stop. But to your point, the exchanges, officers continue to be sent, you know. Mexican officers would go to the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth or U.S. Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. U.S. officers would continue to go south, but it returned to sort of the status quo ante prior to Perry.
Okay.
Formal, distant. This is on the Army side. Mexican Navy continues
Different
to have great
story,
relationships.
Yeah. Oh.
That's going fine. So. Defensa and Northcom basically don't talk to each other. Now, the Secretary General Vega Garcia maintained a relationship with, not a close relationship, but a formal relationship with Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, with the Chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Richard Myers. But it was almost pure protocol. Not a lot was getting done. Mm-hmm. And that sort of continues up through the election of President Felipe Calderon.
Okay, so things are not so good during Fox.
You're right. Well, not so good in a number of ways. If ask a Mexican, especially Army officer, mm-hmm. what they think of President Fox's tenure, and you read some of the things that President Fox said, he's not a fan of anybody's armed forces, yeah. and he's not a fan of Mexican armed forces. You know, he would say, you know, we don't have an army. The Guatemalan army could beat us, and says things that are really sort of demeaning to the Mexican army. So there was not a lot of love lost there. But again, if you're in uniform, you're obedient to the commander in chief. You don't say anything in public, mm-hmm. but in private, they weren't fans. Mm-hmm. So things kind of, again, revert to sort of a status quo ante.
What about the 9/11 effect and the creation of the NORTHCOM? Did that have any kind of effect on?
So I was about to say effect on cooperation, but before we listen to Craig's answer, it's time to take a little break and have a listen to that mystery speech by a mystery leader. I think this one's going to be pretty easy to figure out who he is. Hint, he's English. If you get the answer, email me at perimeterpodcast@gmail.com and you will win a Carlos Quinto chocolate bar, which I will send to you DHL. No, I won't.
That the settlement of the Czechoslovakian problem, which has now been achieved, is, in my view, only the prelude to a larger settlement in which all Europe may find peace. This morning, I had another talk with the German Chancellor, Herr Hitler. And here is the paper which bears his name upon it as well as mine. Some of you perhaps have already heard what it contains, but I would just like to read it to you. We, the German Führer and Chancellor, and the British Prime Minister, have had a further meeting today and are agreed in recognizing that the question of Anglo-German relations is of the first importance for the two countries and for Europe. We regard the agreement signed last night and the Anglo-German naval agreement as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again. We are resolved that the method of consultation shall be the method adopted to deal with any other questions that may concern our two countries, and we are determined to continue our efforts to remove possible sources of difference and thus to contribute to assure the peace of Europe.
It did, and to a negative degree, because and not because the U.S. wasn't trying, The first commander of Northern Command, General Eugene Eberhardt, made multiple requests to come down and visit. Those were always denied. When it started to change, the big change came about, without getting into the minutia, came about when Calderon is elected. And even prior to meeting with President Bush, if you've taken a look at his book, what, Los Retos Que Enfrentamos, or whatever. His very first chapter is all about national security. And so he, in his mind, he was convinced that that corruption had been tolerated far too long, and that, you know, in particular within the Mexican law enforcement. And so he had, he was going to have to turn to the Mexican military to start going after the narcos. And of course, we can talk about the unintended consequences of all that, and the spike in violence that, that would ensue. But in terms of the bilateral security relationship, you know, Calderon asked for President Bush's cooperation. Keyword, not assistance, but cooperation for the first time, because it is, you know, all of this is driven by U.S. demand, of course. Even though we've tended to try and not say that deliberately, but that it's clear. And so between Calderon and Bush, they commit to what turns out to be eventually, of course, the Merida Initiative. And we see a significant increase in cooperation funding on the U.S. side, and a greater emphasis by the Mexican military, directed by the president, by President Calderon, to get involved, not in, in just the eradication of amapola and marijuana, but to go after the drug trafficking organizations. And so we see a dramatic increase in intelligence cooperation and law enforcement cooperation and in defense cooperation. And,
well,
and
what did that look, what did that look like? What did defense cooperation look like?
Right. So, again, prior to Mérida and during Fox and Vega García, there was no relationship with Northern Command. So now Calderon says, you will cooperate with the gringos, make it happen. And so the new Secretary of Defense, General Galvan starts, he visits his counterpart in Northern Command, Air Force General Gene Renwart, and they start talking. And the message is, look, we've got an entire security cooperation system that is ready to cooperate with you guys. Let's sit down and talk about it. And of course, so within the interagency of both countries, both in the U.S. and in Mexico, they hammer out some of the details of Mérida. Mérida, as you know, is not just a defense-to-defense initiative. It was a security initiative, which included law enforcement, included intelligence, included not initially so much, but subsequently judicial reform, et cetera, et cetera. And so we see this really, especially on the defense side, this explosion of greater cooperation. You know, there's always been significant levels of intelligence cooperation between the U.S. and Mexico, and law enforcement as well, but it's the defense change that is dramatic.
Okay, when you say defense cooperation, are we actually seeing U.S. forces in operational missions at any point during the Calderon administration?
Right. So the formal answer, the answer that goes in the papers is no. No, there were no U.S. forces in Mexico. All training continued to be done in the States. But what we did see, and it's not that this had never happened before, U.S. trainers going to Mexico, but not in large numbers. But we start to see an increase in U.S. trainers, both military and U.S. contractors, coming down to do different sorts of training, both in formal schoolhouse settings as well as in training opportunities. But unlike U.S. forces in Colombia, who actually they weren't operating with, but they were accompanying U.S. Colombian forces as they went after the FARC. That was not happening in Mexico.
Okay.
And that was not happening in Mexico because of policy decisions of the Mexican government. And again, back to our historical legacy, you know, we don't want that sort of cooperation. Thanks very much. Training, yes, but that's as far as it went.
Okay, and that, I mean, most Mexicans know that, so that's not a state secret or anything like that. So really, I mean, you called it a cooperation arrangement, but it really was. I mean, in practicality, it was assistance in the sense that the United States. Yes, there was the part where it said that, you know, the United States takes co-responsibility, and I guess that's a big deal. That was big. It was the first time that anything like that had ever happened. But it was essentially, you know, a transfer of equipment and training. At least in Mérida 1. I don't see it as anything much more than that. Do you?
So here's the deal there. So in formal U.S. legalese terms, you know, we do security assistance. That's the term of art within our legislation. Mm-hmm. So by a U.S. Legislative standard, yes, it was security assistance.
Okay.
But let's put things into perspective, and I should have these figures off the top of my head, but I don't. Mm-hmm. When we talk about the amount of cooperation or assistance that the U.S. Congress authorized and appropriated for Mérida, it pales in comparison with what the Mexican government was investing or spending on their own security.
Fair enough, yes.
Right? And so it's not as though you're talking about, and I'm not going to mention a country's name, but an impoverished country out there that you know, they get $2 million of U.S. assistance and it's 75% of their defense budget. You know, this... Our level of cooperation. So the initial plan for Mérida was, I think, $1.4 billion over the first three-year period, and since it began formally, sort of in 2008, I think the number is above $2 billion now. But the Mexican government has far exceeded that in terms of its own resources that it's provided. And so the Mexicans would say, and I would agree, that the key issue here was not that they were receiving all this, you know, this funding to cooperate. What they were receiving was cooperation in that we were training together and starting to become increasingly knowledgeable of each other's capabilities and doctrine.
Okay.
And that was a huge change from the way we had interacted with each other historically, where even though, you know, the Mexican military in certain ways may have taken U.S. manuals, translated them, and adopted them to their own doctrine, mm-hmm. but increasingly, especially now, especially in the last several years, I'm sort of getting ahead of myself, but the Mexican military is being much more deliberate about wanting to be able to understand U.S. doctrine, to be able to interoperate if it were to be necessary.
That's interesting.
And that's big.
Yeah, let's bracket that for a second. The way I see Mérida, though, was like the first time where a Mexican president like explicitly says, you know, we need help on this.
Right.
And that was, I mean, by Mexican political standards, that was unheard of. But I mean, you know, there's different ways of looking at it, and I'll
right.
accept that. But you know, I was very optimistic about Mérida when it first came. I thought it was like the beginning of the beginning, so to speak, right? And it didn't quite happen. At least not. We didn't see a big announcement with respect to a Mérida dos. Well, we did to some extent, but it wasn't really the same kind of thing. It was about community building and so forth. But how do you see the post first iteration Mérida defense relationship?
Right. So it's an interesting point. The Obama administration came in during the middle of the Calderon sexenio, right? And as you well know, in large part significantly changed many of its policies around the world, of U.S. foreign policy, whether it was, you know, pick a subject, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, Cuba, you name it. One of the few things that it maintained largely in place was Merida. And in fact, there was talk within the Beltway that they were going to call it, you know, either Beyond Merida or, as you mentioned a second ago, Merida 2.0. At the end of the day, they didn't do any of that. They continued to simply call it the Merida Initiative, although, as you also correctly pointed out, it became less focused on hardware and on the military and much more focused on soft power, if you will. Judicial reform, safe cities, training of police, and this, that, and the other, and less of an emphasis on the military side. And, you know, I remember talking with the then senior director for Western Hemisphere Affairs on the NSC, Dan Restrepo, about this change as they were going through it. And my argument to him was, look, at the end of the day, those sorts of soft power reforms that you're talking about, judicial reform, improvements in education, those are Mexican government responsibilities. You know, who were we to be coming in and saying, you know, this is how we do, you know, accusatorial, vice inquisitorial,
judicial legal issues.
And so you should do it as well. But apparently that was somewhat welcome. That sort of surprised me. I thought we should have continued to the extent it was necessary on the hard side, the kinetic side, if you will, because in my view, that soft side is absolutely crucial. It needs to happen, but that's a long-term project the government of Mexico and the Mexican society at the end of the day need to undertake. Whereas in the short term, you know, the house is on fire. Send us fire trucks. Send us water. Let's deal with the effects of going after the DTOs and the carnage that's ensuing between the DTOs and collateral damage with civilians.
So what about Peña Nieto?
So each of the chapters, I organized the book, as you know, around sexenios, which I think is a little bit different. You know, typically, a U.S. author would write them around U.S. administrations, but I deliberately did so around a sexenio. And when I finished writing the book in, you know, the summer of last year, so a summer ago, a year ago now, the Peña Nieto sexenio was two years in. It wasn't even halfway. So that it wasn't a full chapter. It was an epilogue.
Right.
And I note in the chapter that things started off well, but things started to turn.
Okay.
You know, despite Peña Nieto's intent to sort of minimize, you know, say, hey, don't pay attention to all this violence and the drug trafficking organizations and the transnational criminal organizations. I want to focus on education reform, on energy reform, on legal reform. And he started off pretty well. And the El Pacto, you know, the pact that he came up with was actually encouraging at the outset. But then we saw, and I note the two cases of Tlatlaya and Ayotzinapa, and despite the fact that they tried to move away from this very close security and defense and intelligence cooperation that had been set up under the Calderón sexenio, you know, they come in, what's one of the first things they do? They create this Ventanilla Única under Gobernación to say, hey, man, there's way too much cooperation going on here. Slow this stuff down. Requests go through a single window. You go through Gobernación, not SRE. You go through Gobernación so we can get a handle on this. And that's what they tried to do initially. But after a couple of years, when they realized that it was just slowing things down, it reverted back to sort of where we were before in terms of great significant levels of intelligence, security, and defense cooperation. So the other big watershed, of course, is the Trump effect. So even though we're at the, you know, beyond the halfway mark in the Peña Nieto sexenio, and I don't have to tell you the challenges that his administration is going through in terms of perceptions of corruption with himself, with his administration, governors, you know, across the board, there's all that going on. And then we have candidate Trump coming in, you know, pledging to do all sorts of things with regard to the southern neighbor, highly offensive things regarding immigration, regarding walls, regarding this, you know, the trade disaster, the greatest disaster in trade deal history, which is NAFTA, which is, of course, bogus. But in any event, that's his campaign message. Mm-hmm. And you pointed out I had the privilege of serving for a month in the new administration to include the cancellation of President Peña Nieto's visit because of tweeting going back and forth, and the rather unfortunate phone call between the two presidents there in late January. And here's the interesting piece. So despite challenges that President Peña Nieto has going on in Mexico, despite different challenges that President Trump and his administration has as they're trying to get their footing and trying to change a number of things here, underneath the radar, the U.S.-Mexico defense relationship continues very strong.
I was going to say that's the case in Canada, U.S. as well. You know, that obviously the same kind of comments weren't made with respect to Canada, not even close, right? But some comments were made,
sure,
particularly with respect to trade. Some of them actually true, by the way, but I shouldn't be saying that.
Right.
Everyone knows that the relationship on the security cooperation and the defense cooperation is not even going to be close to being touched.
Oh, especially with Trudeau.
Yeah, with Trudeau and what Trudeau and Trump say. Yeah, especially in the case with Canada. Yeah,
I mean, the only country that could arguably any closer in a certain way might be the UK, but the security and intelligence relationship between the Canadians and the U.S. Yeah. I mean, and I don't want to say 51st. It's just there's nothing.
No,
else
no, it
like
is. I mean, look, Canadians.
We're integrated.
Canadians look. Canadians recognize that Canadian national security depends on cooperation with the United States. Its territoriality is a function of defense of its territoriality is a function of the United States. And this goes back to NORAD and, and even before that, the Second World War. Okay, so you were about to say that in spite of these differences at the presidential level, that there was something there, that there is something there, and that continues.
Yes.
In spite of these problems.
And so, it continues for, I think, two very important but basic reasons. The U.S. Department of Defense, even though Secretary Mattis is not a Latin Americanist, he doesn't know the region. He has experience in other parts of the world, but he's a learned man. He's a well-read man, and he listens to his advisors. He has been briefed on how far this relationship has come, and how we should take care to not upset it. But more importantly, I think for our purposes here, and this will be when I ever do a second edition of the book, because this it's an important story. At the senior level of not just the Mexican administration, but the Mexican military. The Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of the Navy value what this type of cooperation over the past almost 10 years now during the Calderon sexenio and what we have so far of the Peña Nieto sexenio, it has been a net positive for the Mexican Armed Forces. The analogy I always use is, so say you and I both play tennis, Aki, we're both kind of mediocre. If we continue to play tennis together, we're not going to get any better. But if you start playing with Serena Williams or I start playing with Rafael Nadal, they're still going to kick our butts, but our game will improve, the quality of our,
right.
Because when you're playing with somebody better. And I have made this case to Mexican general officers and admirals, and they've not pushed back. That simply, say what you will, you can disagree with U.S. policies or whatnot, but the U.S. military is the best trained military in the world, and they train very well. And so if you're exposed to that, if you're playing single A ball, but you get exposed to playing with the Yankees, that the quality of your game is going to elevate. And they have seen that, and they value that. It's a much it's a much better trained military than it was 10 years ago, simply by exposure to training with another set of professionals. And they had been isolated from a lot of that.
Yeah, and my sense is that they're not so nationalistic as they were, let's say, maybe 10, 15 years ago.
That's the other huge piece that I'm not going to say that the levels of distrust that had been generated over the 200 years of our shared history have gone away, but they have been attenuated. And they've been attenuated through one of the former U.S. Northern Command commanders, who I think was arguably did one of the best jobs there, retired General Chuck Jacoby, was one of these guys who liked to under-promise and over-deliver. And and that's what they and he earned a genuine degree of trust from his counterparts, and so if the U.S. and that's one of the reasons why I thought it was important to write the book now, if we can maintain that, and that's why I'm sort of optimistic, irrespective of the political pronouncements that come out of either president on either side, it appears that for the first time ever in our shared history, senior leadership on both sides of the border truly understands the other better and truly appreciates the value of cooperating. That doesn't mean that, you know, that Mexico is going to join NATO and the next time we deploy someplace, there are going to be Mexican units doing that. That's not what I'm saying. But it is saying that that if there's ever a disaster, you know, an earthquake, a flood, a hurricane that hits in the border area, whether it's in the Gulf or in San Diego, our forces, which have these great logistic capabilities to provide disaster relief and humanitarian assistance at those moments, will be able to communicate and operate unlike they've ever been able to do before. And who knows where that may lead in the future.
Okay, can I ask you one last quick question? What's your view? What do you think of Cienfuegos? How has he managed the defense relationship?
Well, the defense relationship...
The present Secretary of Defense in Mexico, for those who don't know.
Sure. So that is... that's part of the good news story. And what... Mm-hmm. And let me just say this, and you know this having read the book, I deliberately don't get into or avoid trying to get into critiquing whatever policies may or may not be happening in Mexico. I don't think it corresponds to me. Those are for Mexican analysts to do. What I focus on is the relationship between senior leaders. And so the fascinating and encouraging, and this is, again, why I see the glass is half full and I'm guardedly optimistic, is that General Cienfuegos is an old school guy. He's a guy who was brought up in a Mexican military that completely distrusted the U.S. military and our intent and objectives. And he now is clearly, at least from an observer status from afar, he is bought into the fact that this is a net good for his institution, and it appears to be committed to maintaining it, and that's why I'm
That's why I brought him up, because it is interesting that you have somebody from the old guard.
Yep.
He just turned 68, so he grew up in all that mess in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, and yet he's he's surprisingly open. And we haven't spoken about the Navy, but they've been just moving forward on in a completely different speed.
Sure.
With the U.S. and with the U.S. Coast Guard in particular, like you said, what about here? I'll make this the last question. What about Mexico in an expanded and by expanded I mean missions, an expanded NORAD?
Well, that's a great question that allows me to use another great U.S. Secretary of Defense who was the only one to have ever visited Mexico twice. So Perry visited in 95. Cohen never went. Rumsfeld never went. Gates came in, went twice, once when he was working for Bush, once when he was working for Obama, and has this great saying. He said, and after having, you know, and the guy's a consummate professional, you know, CIA, career CIA guy, NSC multiple tours, gets the big picture. And after being exposed to Mexico a little bit, he gets it. And he says, look, the U.S. is always is willing and ready to cooperate with Mexico. But the foot that's always needs to be on the gas pedal and on the brake needs to be a Mexican foot. We will go as fast as they want,
yeah,
and we will slow down when they want to slow down. And as long as senior defense leaders in the U.S. understand that, I think it's – and we don't try and push too much on them and let them go at their own pace. Again, I'm optimistic.
Thanks, Craig.
Hey, my pleasure.
It's gone over an hour. If you're interested in picking up his book, it's available on Amazon. It's also available on ebook format on Amazon. And I imagine in other booksellers as well, traditional booksellers. It's a great book. I really enjoyed it. Once again, Craig, thank you for being on the Security Perimeter podcast.
Okay, thanks so much for the opportunity. It was great to talk to you, my friend.
See you soon. See you at ISA.
Well, if not before. Te mando un abrazo fuerte.
Definitivamente.